So, hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we're going to be looking at quite a hot topic, I guess, in the current political spectrum, which is the franking credits and proposed changes to franking credits. So we've entitled this one, Franking Credits and You. We'll jump across into our agenda. So we're going to be looking at some background into the franking credits. Also, if Labor wins, and of course, a lot of this is predicated on the fact that the legislation actually does come through in the current form, and there may be some changes in the wind, perhaps, in order for them to get it through. Perhaps not if they have a roaring victory, which is predicted as well, that might help their case in being able to pull through absolutely everything that they're looking for. But the point of it is, if these policies as they stand are implemented, we're going to look into how to structure your investments given these changes. Some bit of insight, I guess, from a funds management and investment point of view on Australian versus international company valuation changes. Also changes to company incentives and payout ratios, which of course Australia is known for its very high levels of payout ratios under the current system, and that may be subject to change, perhaps, so we'll look into that as well. And then, as always, we will round out with an investment outlook and some reflection on how we run our portfolios every day at the MB Fund and Nucleus Wealth. So I'll welcome the man sitting beside me here, our head of investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And we'll jump right into it. So just a quick bit of background, what are franking credits? So essentially, if you are watching at home, and I will make the charts available, of course, in a link in the podcast as well. But essentially, a company, for example, here creates $100 worth of earnings, which is then turned into an after-tax profit of $70, with the tax going to the ATO. It then lands, the $70 then lands in the dividend holders or the shareholders' pocket. And then it's depending on their own tax affairs, they can be able to then get a credit of up to $30 back, rounding it back up to $100. Does that sound about right, Damien?
Yeah, basically. It's a system set up to avoid double taxation. And it's the question sort of brought up from these changes now is that as with any tax rules, they always get gamed, and so there's a bunch of people now who are getting who have managed to avoid any taxation. So you've gone from it was originally designed to be avoid double taxation, and there are people out there with zero taxation, and so just trying to come up with the right balance to sort of draw the line down the middle.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely. So a quick bit of background. So up until the late 1990s, franking credits were able to be used to offset tax obligations, and we'll go into this in a moment, but not to be taken as any excess to be taken as a check from the ATO, essentially. 2001 or 2002, it came into effect. We saw changes in the law that then allowed this to actually happen. So any excess franking credits from your personal tax position after your tax was effectively netted out was then returned to you as cash, and as we know, still exists today. And now with 2019 rolling along, nearly 20 years later, the potential incoming Labor government has proposed to wind it back essentially to the old method, where with some conditions, obviously, where you can use it to offset tax liabilities, but then you forfeit any additional or excess credits.
Yeah, because the other one, which not on that list, but sort of in the 2000s as well, the laws changed to reduce the tax on superannuation. Mm-hmm. In pension phase to zero.
Okay.
And that's the other sort of double effect, because if we have seen the change in the franking credits without that, it wouldn't have been as much of an issue.
Sure.
Because people would still have to pay tax on what they've got. So a lot of it is the fact that you've ended up with people in a zero tax environment in their pension, and some of those people are very, very wealthy, and they're making a fortune from it and claiming back tax which they've never paid, and so they're paying zero tax on. Not only they're paying zero tax themselves, but on their investments, but also they're sort of getting a look through. Having said that, though, the problem is you've got people that are, you're trying to solve two different problems with this, and the solution that's come up is sort of sits somewhere in the middle. So it's basically you're trying to fix the problem where you've got some very high income earners who are getting tax free income. The problem is you're also, as part of the change, it's also capturing some people who aren't very high income earners and are sort of just outside the pension part of the Australian economy.
Mm.
And so there's sort of the poorer investors. And that's where you're hearing the most amount of noise. Having said that, though, I think a lot of the noise is funded by the people who are losing a hell of a lot, and they're trying to push down and get the greater numbers at that sort of poorer end to come up. And
the more relatable end to the everyday Australian.
Exactly, and sort of explain to, you know, I was a retired this or a retired school teacher or whatever it is, and I'm going to miss out on all this money that I should have got, and this is keeping me off the pension and stuff like that. And some of those people have very valid arguments.
Mm.
It's just that we think most of it's being sort of funded by the big end of town who are losing some really significant amounts of money.
Yep.
That where they're just literally getting tax-free income.
Mm. Or it just becomes tax to them, essentially. So taxed by another name. Okay, sure. So I've got a quick scenario here, and I guess this is just to illustrate the point you made before. Why is it important, and why are these various parties upset with these proposed changes? And so I've got a basic scenario here of 200K in assets yielding 5%, so $10,000 a year a dividend, with coming along fully franked with a $3,000 amount in franking credits. So for the median Australian who just owns these shares in his back pocket or her back pocket on $67,000, that actually all of those franking credits would be eaten up, and they'd have to pay an additional $250 tax on that additional $10K investment. Mm-hmm. This is obviously just a worked example. Once again, if you use that person in superannuation, in accumulation, if you add in the income for the fund, if assuming that $200K was sitting in just in superannuation and no other investments, and also the tax that's payable on their superannuation guarantee, then you'd find that they'd get $544 tax back. Now, obviously, very basic example here. Then we switch across to probably the more visible, I guess, in this argument at the moment. Mm. So retirees that are who are in a position where they've got around about the $18,000 or the tax-free threshold in taxable earnings, would then get the $3,000 tax back. And likewise, if you've got a self-managed super fund in the tax-free pension mode, you'd be getting that tax back as well currently. So then if we look to after the changes are in place, you've now essentially in a position where any of those tax back situations now become a tax. They become lost. Mm. And if you can extrapolate that over, depending on the amount of money you've got invested, this can be sizable. And for a lot of people, and that's the other thing with... I think it's very important that you actually look at your own position as opposed to just saying, okay, they're going to take something off me, therefore I'm against it. You need to make sure that you're actually in a position where you might be, detrimental to you.
And we will go through a few ways you can restructure to not lose as much of that in benefits.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Okay, so a quick broad brush, and this has been put together, is essentially that the Labor changes will affect 1.2 million of taxpayers, or about 8%. And of that, 200,000 of the 600,000 SMSFs are liable or likely to be affected. The changes would start, obviously, at the start of the next financial year, and charities and other not-for-profit organisations such as universities will be exempt, along with age pensioners as well. So that's a pretty key condition, I think, certainly creating an exemption for the changes, where it may, obviously have a big impact on people that they're not intending it to impact.
And I think from our perspective, we highlight that there's some of the key people who are complaining about this, or certainly whose cases are being put up as post childs, of being the people who are just outside the age pension system and are basically using the franking credits to help mean that they're not on the age pension system.
Mm-hmm.
And we think there's some benefit, some validity to them. And so maybe if you had some sort of tapering or something like that, and that's most likely where sort of any negotiation would be done.
Yep.
You'd like to think. But yeah, the issue of saying, are you capturing, and that's your next slide, is are you capturing the richest people and actually getting them to pay tax once,
yep.
at least, rather than zero times? We think that's a very valuable sort of thing to capture from this whole process.
100%. And, so, and as you've noticed, and we'll jump across in a sec, but just that bottom fact there, with 50% of the refunds are going to the wealthiest 10% of SMSFs, and the top 1% of SMSFs receive an average cash refund of $83,000 a year. So for most people, what they're probably looking to draw out is as an income. The largest SMSFs are getting this as basically a tax back sort of check. Yeah.
So these are people who are probably making $250,000
or more,
or plus in in dividends,
yep,
and are paying zero tax,
yep,
on that. And not only that, they're turning back around and saying, well, not only paid zero tax on the $250,000 I just got from dividends, can I also have another $83,000 back from money you collected from companies?
Yeah, that's right. And just touching on the point before where I made about the taxable income. So this is where you've got to be a little bit careful with the way that people present themselves, and particularly in the media. So it's quite an interesting stat. It was put together by the Grattan Institute. It's quite recent, but it essentially shows the income, the taxable income brackets for the various wealth deciles. So for those listening at home, running from if you have an average wealth of less than 1,000 up to an average wealth of 1.9 million, and sort of it's broken up. Now, the interesting thing to drag out of this is that pretty much consistently, and at least 40% of every one of those deciles reports an average of or the component of that decile in the number of people have a taxable income of less than 18,200. Mm. So when you've got a person out the front of courthouse,
let me just put that into perspective. If you're earning less than $1,000 a year on average, you know, 40% of people get into that. If they have an average wealth of less than $1,000, then they're 40% of people in that bracket are reporting less than $18,000. In income, but right at the other end, when you have over $2 million in assets, there's still only 40% of people reporting that they've got $18,200.
Spot on. And you might ask, well, how is that possible? Well, the bulk of it would be sitting in things like self-managed super funds, where income that you draw out of the self-managed super fund as a pension is not counted as taxable income. So whilst you might say to the tax man, okay, in my own name, I've earned $18,000 or less, therefore I'd like my franking credit, please, but don't worry about looking at the $5 million I've got in my SMSF, because that doesn't apply. So,
and there's other people with very obviously clever, the richer you are, the cleverer your accountant can be, and the whole process of, you know, a lot of their job is to move money around and make sure you're not paying tax. And so
100%. And I guess a component of the reason why, you know, every single decile has at least 40%, so nearly one in two people in every wealth band sits under the 18.2, is probably exactly that, because our accountants are getting very, very good at this, getting quite smart. So anyway, so we'll jump across now into investment structuring, and I guess really what it means for you. So I guess the key thing is, and we'll just look at two different versions at the moment. So we'll look at personal super and self-managed super, because for a lot of people, that's where, you know, the issue is going to lie.
And so what Tim means by that is personal super is your default super that sits in an industry fund or on a platform like we use Praemium as an example. Like, so someone's where it's managed by a third party, you haven't actually set up a legal structure yourself, it's just your normal super. And then the SMSF is a self-managed super where you've actually set yourself up an individual self-managed super account to manage it yourself.
Spot on. Yep, that's right. So yeah, anything, or another term for it in the industry is called a master trust, where they look after the superannuation. It's perhaps a big fund or a pool. So I guess, look, number one is you need to have a look at your own superannuation account, particularly if you're in accumulation, to see whether or not you are generating enough taxable income. So what I mean by that is the income that's earned inside of the fund, along with contributions that are made to the fund, because both are taxed at 15%, creates a tax liability that then these franking credits will offset, you know, before they go to zero and before you start missing out on money. So that's probably the first thing to start having a look at before getting a bee in the bonnet. The other thing as well, I guess, and the remainder sort of sit more for those that are sitting in a pension account in one of these master trusts, is and there's quite an interesting review out in Cufflinks today, Graham Hand put together on exactly this topic, which is reviewing whether or not you have enough accumulation members to your pension side of the fund. And what I mean by that is that in a pooled account, if you've got a lot of accumulation members that are in the taxable side of superannuation, they're contributing money into the fund through superannuation guarantee and additional contributions. Their income itself is taxed, so overall the fund is incurring a tax liability, which then the franking credits from your investment can help to negate, which should overall lift the performance of the fund, because it's not being lost to tax, it's being, you know, being used to offset that and keep that money in the fund. But as a, and I'll jump to the fourth point there, that the other thing you need to make sure of is that there is some form of thought in the fact that you actually are getting the you know, the benefits of your largesse of sharing your credits in the fund.
And so this is the uncertain bit, isn't it? Because we haven't seen the wording of the law and things like that. Is that you don't know for sure if there's a look through into into the fund effectively, then they'll be looking through and saying, well, you don't get those because you're in pension mode. If there's not a look through, then the benefits will be shared, and how they get shared is a part, again, we just don't know.
Absolutely. That.
Sitting these master trust structures do tend to pull a lot of things. All the industry funds are pretty famous for being able to pull their entertainment expenses and charge them back to members.
Yep.
So yeah, so there's a lot of issues with that pooling, and then at the moment, lots of you know, capital gains tax gets pooled with all these funds and doesn't get applied to who it actually applied to and who it didn't apply to. It's just sort of grouped up. So it's quite possible that it will just be pooled and you'll get some of the benefit, but. There is also a possibility that they'll try and do some sort of look through into these, and so you won't get the benefit anyway.
Absolutely. And the other thing, I guess, is if you say, "Well, Tim, how do I know the accumulation to pension membership of your fund?" Well, to be honest with you, it'd be very hard to find even as an advisor. But I'd suggest that as these changes become closer to be actually coming in place, and this sort of becomes this sort of desire for this information becomes more relevant, you'll find probably a couple of things. Number one is, I guess, an easy one is that you can have a look at your fund. And if it's generally targeted to young members, so REST is a good example. It, you know, generally looks after people that are in the retail industry, which is, you know, typically a younger workforce. It could be a rule of thumb as to whether or not, you know, those franking credits will get captured within the fund or given back. And the other thing too, actually, is quite interesting is Colonial First State have come out and actually just stated the various products that they've got. And for example, First Choice was one that they came out and said, that's going to be okay. We've got a big accumulation component. So, it, you know, we'll be able to soak up those franking credits, whereas opposed to First Wrap was the other way around. Too many pension members and not enough accumulation. So there is a chance that they'll be lost. So these are the things that hopefully super funds will take it upon themselves to make clear. If you're in the pension mode, I'd certainly be, you know, having a bit of a look or asking the question, going forward. Very good. Okay, so just when we'll jump across now from the personal super to the self-managed super funds. It's an interesting one because obviously self-managed super funds, you get more control, and that's one of the key reasons why people like them and are in them. As long as you're in accumulation mode in your SMSF, there's potentially no changes, because as long as your tax liabilities, as I mentioned before, income and you know, tax paid on income in the fund, and also the contribution tax equals your franking credits or thereabouts or less, then there's no real issue there. In the pension mode, of course, though, you stand to lose those franking credits, and that's the big topic.
And that's where a lot of people sort of structured and got SMSFs so they could actually directly 100%. Access their franking credits was part of the allure of SMSFs.
Absolutely. And so, look, to combat that going forward, one option you may have, if it is available to you, is to start introducing accumulation members to your fund, so you can generate these tax liabilities that you can then use to soak up your credits. So there's definitely some strategies around that, I think, going forward for those who feel they're in a, you know, a well-run SMSF, or they're in charge of it, so you'd like to think so, and they're also perhaps have some you know, adult kids maybe with reasonable balances that they can bring in. Maybe they're adding more money in as well.
And it's not as much the balances as the money that's being added each
year.
That's
true, yeah.
But it doesn't actually... The other thing is, it was a very good one you brought up earlier, is it doesn't need to be that much. So if you had about $1 million balance, for example, so quite a sizable amount, and you're earning, you had about, 30% of that in Aussie equities, earning franked credits.
Yep.
I think you need maybe $50,000.
Yeah, something like that.
Somebody
yeah.
earning $50,000, not putting $50,000 per year,
that's
just
right.
Somebody on a salary of $50,000,
yep.
adding their, whatever it is, $4,000 or $5,000 a year in.
That's right. Yeah. And then that on top of the accumulation of any balance they've got, the increase of any balance they've got in the tax payable on that. So it doesn't take a lot. You don't need to, you know, bring in the entire family and the family dog. Interestingly enough as well, while we are talking about proposed changes is there is a proposed member increase for SMSFs from currently sitting at 4, or as they say, less than 5. They're looking at bumping that up to 6, which is, I guess, lending itself to the fact that, you know, SMSFs can become, in a way, a family superannuation fund as opposed to generally just being a mum and dad, as we've seen the stats have shown, that, you know, 50% or more are sitting in just two member land. So some things to think about, I think, going forward, particularly if you're in pension mode and you're worried about the franking credits. Obviously, an option is to wind up your fund and put it in a retail fund and go down the previous slide. But there are also a few levers you can pull in your existing fund if those opportunities arise and if you've got some people there. Very good. Okay, so we'll jump across from the strategy and the up to date, and we'll jump into some investment chats.
So this is more about, you know, what. So you want to buy companies, and if you're investing, you want to be buying companies, and you want to know whether your company's going to change what they're doing. So there's sort of two parts to this. One is how much should you be paying for companies with and without franking credits, and the second part is will companies change what they're doing because of the rule changes. So the first part, the valuation side, I've got an example up on screen, which I'll just read through for people just listening on the podcast. But I'm basically comparing the after-tax return for investing in Australian stocks versus investing in international stocks. Now, what happens is if you're on a 0% tax rate with a franking rebate. And I've basically said that if in Australia, let's say that the yield is 4.5% and you get a 2.5% share price change, which gives you a sort of 7% total return, versus investing in the US, where you're getting more like a 2% dividend yield, but the share price change is going up at, say, 5%. So the total return on both is the same. Mm-hmm. One just comes from capital gains, the other one comes from share price.
Yep.
Is that if you're under the current scenario, you're about 1.5% better off investing in Australian shares.
Right. Yep.
So the idea is that, and that comes back from franking credits. If you're on the top marginal tax rate, the difference is down to 0.2%. So it's basically negligible difference between investing internationally and investing in Australia if you're expecting a similar return from both. And then under the new scenario, though, it actually goes back to an even. If you're on a 0% tax rate, it goes back to an even. So what it means is that if you're looking at your portfolio and going, well, should I invest more in Australia or more offshore? The first thing I would say is tax should be at best a secondary, probably a third or a fourth or a fifth or a tenth order.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to know, am I going to make a return, positive return from this or not?
Mm.
Because, you know, even at best, it's 1.5%. And it's under the new scenarios, it's more likely to be pretty close to zero. And that's a very, very small change. That's a one-day change, in an average stock to totally blow away any gains you might have got.
Yep.
So the first thing is you should be always start from investing from a return basis. But the second part then is saying, well, if you were thinking I'll buy lots of Australian shares because I love those franking credits, and you're in pension mode, then any of those gains are going to go away under the new scenario.
Yep. Okay. Sure thing.
Mm. So that's one part of the valuation. The second part of the valuation is how much will people actually pay for shares in Australia versus overseas. And there's a lot that's been written on this, and people sort of look at how much shares fall when dividends get paid in Australia, and how much shares fall when dividends get paid overseas, and you come up with all these different quantitative methods to try and work out, you know, do people value franking credits, and how much do they value franking credits, and what does that mean for the valuation of a company when you want to, you know, you're putting together a discounted cash flow or even just PEs and things like that. The what tends to show is that the net effective franking credits is somewhere between 0% and 50%, because there remember there is a timing difference as well. So franking credits are great, but you don't get them for another, you know, year or so after the dividends are actually paid. And so foreign investors don't value franking credits. So it all comes back to who is the marginal buyer in Australia.
Okay.
So if you're looking at a stock and it's a big stock like a BHP or something like that, the argument is this is an international stock. There's lots and lots of international buyers who buy it. And so the person who's deciding the price isn't an Australian. Mm. It's an international person. And in which case they don't value the franking credits, or they value it at a small level, depending upon how tricky they are about managing to extract some value from it. which is an ongoing game that goes on where companies work out, accountants work out ways to get value back to foreigners, and then governments close up the loopholes, and then they work out different ways. And so, you know, you're always in that some sort of loop around those
but
ones.
But once again, it's sort of a bonus as opposed to a hard and fast rule.
Oh, and they know it's going to get closed up once it becomes too popular, and then,
yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I guess from that perspective, given that I need to come back and say, well, that's large companies. The argument is for smaller companies that it's more likely that the marginal buyer will actually be an Australian investor.
Mm, okay,
and
sure.
So at that point, the franking credits should be worth more, and maybe it's closer to 50% or more than 50% for some companies, because the marginal buyer will be an Australian now getting those franking credits.
Yep.
So presumably removing this franking credit refund is going to make a difference, and reduce that number a bit,
mm-hmm.
Especially because it brings a third option into it. Because at the moment you're going, I've got either an international investor or an Australian investor who values franking credits,
mm-hmm.
and now we're adding a third person, which is an Australian investor who doesn't value franking credits.
Mm.
And so I guess I would be arguing that that last category probably isn't going to be that large or large enough, but maybe in some cases it will be.
Mm.
And so it's, if anything, you know, the value of franking credits will probably be reduced, which will mean the Australian stocks at the margin will probably trade on a little bit lower of a multiple compared to the world.
Okay.
So,
and just on that note, when you talk about introducing this third person who doesn't value franking, do you think, and this is just, I guess, broad thought, but do you think that will have an effect now? Because let's say, for example, Telstra. Now, you've got buy and hold for life Telstra holders that just love big dividends, big payouts, and we've seen what's happened to the Telstra share price.
Even if they keep going down.
Yeah, even if they lose half their money on the capital, but that's okay, I've got my precious dividend. Mm. So do you think that, obviously now, if let's just say they flick from being in pension, they're in pension mode and the rules change, and so now all of a sudden they're a lot more mindful of the capital side as opposed to just getting the fully franked dividend?
Yep.
Do you think that's going to put a lot of or more pressure on either upwards and downwards in prices, probably more downwards?
I guess that's what I'm saying is I think the Australian market trades on a who knows how much, but certainly a premium above what it would trade at if it didn't have franking credits. Now, because this is only doesn't affect everyone, it affects a smaller subset of people,
mm-hmm.
that will reduce, but will it reduce by much? It's hard to tell.
Yep.
I would say there'd be at least a couple, at least a percent or two in it,
mm-hmm.
In terms of the amount that you'd expect Australian stocks to trade to set a little bit lower on the basis that if you are an investor in your pension mode at the moment, you're saying, and I've met plenty of retail investors who literally will say, no, I don't want to buy overseas shares because I don't get franking credits.
Mm.
You know, it's basically, I don't care if that goes up by 20%, mine only goes up by 10%. I want those franking credits.
Yep, yep.
And I've been in arguments with people in which we've both walked away thinking each other are an idiot, where I'm explaining to people that, you can buy this asset without franking credits and get a higher return than if you buy it with franking credits, and they keep saying, but I get money back from the government.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We love to get money back from the government. It's like winning the jackpot,
yep.
You know?
And it probably has a lot to do with our housing bubble as well.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that a lot of that is accountant driven, because it's much better for an accountant to if they can turn around to somebody and say, I just did your tax for you, Tim, and guess what, I got you an extra $3,000 back from franking credits.
Yeah.
You're a happy chappy. Whereas if you've said, oh look, Tim, you actually made a lot more because you invested overseas, but I got no franking credits for you, yeah. So I'm not giving you any money back.
I've just got a bill.
I'm actually giving you a bill. All of a sudden, the accountant doesn't look as good. He's not the hero anymore.
Yeah,
and
the dynamic changes.
And so, I do think there's a philosophical, bent that sort of pushes people into Aussie shares as well.
Yep.
From that perspective.
Yep. Okay. Fantastic.
Driven by their accountants.
So we'll jump across now to company incentives. So effects on capital allocation. This will be interesting.
Yeah. So the issue with this is saying, we know Australian companies pay much higher dividends than international, and part of that is because of the franking.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, does that change the capital allocation of Australian companies? And is that going to be for the better or for the worse? And what's going to happen? So I tend to think of the way companies allocate capital as you start with this thing called free cash flow, which is basically you look at your cash and then you work out what's a, they call it a stay in business or acquired capex. Mm-hmm. So it's basically how much, if I'm running a company, how much is it to replace stuff that's just depreciated? So I've got to buy, you know, if I've got a fleet of cars, I need to buy those new ones. If I've got some factories, I need to buy machines that have worn out or been depreciated. So it's basically just keeping this business going without expanding.
Yep.
So there's a different type of capital expenditure, which is I'm going to go buy a new factory or a new, set up a new office or whatever.
Yep.
That's sort of expansionary, but there's this idea of just keeping your company going.
Sort of like keeping the lights on sort of figure where you just, you know what you've got to hit and then, yep. And then you're the same as last year.
Exactly.
Yep.
So we've got that free cash flow. Then there's this idea of having a minimum level of dividend. Now, most companies don't like to cut their dividends. They tend to think of that as a poor signal.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got this idea that I've got this free cash flow. Now I need to pay my shareholders a dividend of some sort. And there's this bias towards trying to pay the same dividend as last year or more.
Yep.
Then you get to the next stage of saying, okay, now I want to grow this company. What am I going to invest in or sell, or if I want to shrink the company or whatever? So you go through that, you know, how do I grow? Now, and after you've got to that stage, now you start saying, well, how am I going to fund this? So if your number's positive, now you go, okay, well, I've still got money left over. Am I going to pay down my debt or increase my cash, or am I going to give more money back to shareholders?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to give more money back to shareholders, it might be a bigger dividend. Often it's not. It might be a special dividend.
Okay.
It might be a buyback,
mm-hmm.
You know, some other way of giving money back to shareholders. And then if the number's negative, you decide then between saying, do I want to increase my debt or do I want to raise equity to pay for this? So from my perspective, and the order of these though changes, different people think the order of them changes. So from my perspective, that's the way companies look at things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dividend part is not really and the decision about a buyback or to do a buyback or not is not really part of your, is that going to affect my growth capital?
Okay.
As much, because that decision sort of made as being, well, I'm going to make this decision to go and invest, and as long as it's above my hurdle, and then I'm going to try and work out how to fund it.
Yep, sure.
If I think it's worth doing.
Yep.
In Australia, the number two though, this minimum level of dividend basically comes back to I want to pay out as much of my franking credits so as I can, because and that's the difference in Australia is. At that number two step, companies are saying, well, I've just got these franking credits back from the government because I paid this tax. They're doing absolutely no use to me sitting on my balance sheet, so I may as well sell it, give it out to my shareholders as fast as I can.
Yep, okay.
And so that's why Australian companies pay a higher dividend. And that's, I'll just jump to this next chart, which sort of shows the Australian payout ratios being sort of, you know, 70%. So much higher than world payout ratios, almost double.
So just for those listening at home, a payout ratio is?
The dividends divided by the profits.
Okay.
So I made X amount of dollars of profit. Yep. How much of that do I give back as a dividend to shareholders versus how much I reinvest?
Okay, sure.
The thing is though, so if you then flip international companies around though and say, well, what happens if I look at the buybacks that these companies do plus the dividends that they pay out and then compare... Now Australia's sort of advantage or the higher level goes away. You're basically seeing that some years the world's higher than Australia, other years Australia's higher than the world. So basically it's the concept is that companies are actually giving back about the same amount of money to shareholders in Australia as internationally. It's just that internationally they generally choose to do it as a buyback.
As a capital thing, not as an income thing. Yeah,
and that's because usually the income is double taxed overseas, so shareholders actually do want it. They'd prefer it to see it back as a capital gain.
Yep.
And also companies don't like to sort of pay out that high level of dividend because they like to be able to say, oh, we can keep increasing our dividend or keep, you know, they don't leave themselves enough room to say, well, we can keep steady the dividend or keep increasing over the years. And then every now and again, if we've got this excess cash, we'll throw it into a buyback or do something like that.
So just to sort of follow on from that point, so given the changes now proposed, what is a company going to do with this giant franking credit account that will be growing that they, you know, in a way they'll be giving out, but they won't be as so incentivized anymore?
Yeah. So we've obviously seen a bunch of companies coming out now trying to give the money away as fast as they can while people can still... So there's a bunch of special dividends that are sort of floating around the market.
Yep.
To try and empty those franking credits. The issue is... Post this announcement, the franking credits are still beneficial for most people, not for pensioners. But then again, they were never beneficial for foreign investors either.
Okay.
So the idea that you're giving these franking credits back to shareholders as fast as possible because it's worth something to shareholders and it's worth nothing to you still exists, and it still means that a subset of your investors don't get any benefit.
Yep.
It's just now that that's obviously a larger amount than your investors. But and possibly it's quite a vocal amount as well, I suppose, in terms of your pensioners and your older investors. But, you know, from my perspective, I'm still expecting companies to keep their payout ratios very high.
Yep.
You might see a little bit less of these the fancy sort of buybacks type special dividends where they do, you know, they invite people to buy back and they get some funny, you know, rather than just getting cash, you get cash plus franking credits and some sort of mix of everything. I think you'll probably see a lot less of those.
Yep, sure.
But I do think you'll still see quite a high payout ratio from Australian companies in terms of if franking credits are there, they're going to get rid of it because it's still a huge proportion of their investor base value those franking credits.
Still use them.
And it's with that idea that, well, it's a choice between doing that and a buyback. I may as well do that.
Yep.
If the money's going back to shareholders, it may as well come with these franking credits that are some use to some people.
And so has there been any previous sort of examples of such a change happening around the world? Yeah,
a little bit. In Europe, before they went into the euro, a bunch of countries had had franking credits, and they no longer do. So one example, I've just got one up on stage of France, where sort of showing it was paying sort of 80% payout ratios, sort of early 2000s, and then that dropped to sort of 30-something percent once they got rid of franking credits.
Well, that's
and then bounced back to sort of 40-50s eventually.
But keeping in mind that this was a complete removal of franking credits, it wasn't a, you know, some people get it, some people don't sort of scenario.
Exactly.
Like we've got.
Yep, yeah, okay. So as you went into the euro, there was France, Germany, I think the UK to a certain extent, a couple of other countries as well. And so we've seen quite clearly what happens is the thing is that the capital structure didn't change very much.
Mm.
So, you know, there doesn't seem to be very much difference between the amount of debt and the amount of equity that companies were covering. Their buybacks and or things like that, they just managed to keep the debt the same. So I guess that's where I'm coming back to saying, well, our effect's going to be a lot less than this because it's only a relatively minor change to the rules and only affecting a subset of people.
Yep.
And so it's hard to see why it would change, you know, how people allocate capital.
Okay, sure thing. We'll jump into the next one, which is tax avoidance.
Yeah, so again, a number of quite interesting studies on this that show that franking credits actually seem to help companies to not avoid tax. And so domestic companies in particular, so what they tended to notice is countries that took off franking credits tended to notice more of the companies that the companies in that would end up paying a lower tax rate compared to the statutory tax rate than what they did beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea is that companies, when they know that the tax is going back to shareholders as a franking credit, there's less incentive to try and avoid it, because you're saying, well, it doesn't make, you know, I could spend all this money. I've got $100 million tax bill. I could spend $10 million to try and bring that back to $80 million, and it's a win-win for
the company.
For the company, we save a bit. Our accountants get lots of money. But the shareholders miss out on those franking credits. So for the Australian company, in that situation, you go, well, your company's $10 million better off, the accountant's $10 million better off, but the shareholders are actually worse off because they've lost the franking credits.
Yep.
And so maybe I just don't even bother doing that fancy structures and, you know, money through different countries and all that type of stuff in the first place.
Okay, yeah, sure.
And the comparison was, so they basically benchmarked domestic companies versus international companies, and they found that, well, international companies before and after were avoiding just as much tax as they did beforehand.
Okay.
Whereas the domestic ones, you know, lifted the game once franking credits were gone.
Yeah, right. Mm. Fascinating. Okay. Got a little anecdotal.
Yeah, it's just also that part that quite possibly there's a timing difference as well, is that companies are pretty good at, and accountants in particular, are pretty good at delaying tax.
Sure. Yep.
So basically trying to say, well, you know, if the money's sitting in our account rather than sitting in the government's account, then that's a win for a little bit.
Okay.
Whereas with franking credits, there does seem at least anecdotal evidence that companies will go, well, I may as well pay that tax up so that then I can distribute that money as a franking credit back to my shareholders at my next dividend.
Yeah, right. Okay, sure thing. And just a couple of other factors as well. Yeah.
So the other big one people often say is, well, this will benefit Australian companies in that there'll be less incentive to pay dividends, and so they'll actually spend more on CapEx.
Mm.
And having said that, from my point of view, I still haven't drawn this whole... well, actually, there's two parts to that. One is the experience from overseas is no, they'll just do it as a buyback anyway, and mm-hmm. we've seen that very much in the US. The second part is... the effect on CapEx is, you know, is this whole short-termism and people are focused too much on getting money out now, and so they're not worried as much about longer-term CapEx. And so CapEx expenditures sort of, on the flip side, CapEx expenditures has been falling so much for sort of 50-odd years, and some of that's because we've got a lot fewer manufacturers and a lot more service companies than what we used to. And yep. so I've never seen anything that really breaks out the right mix between those.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it'll have an effect. I suspect it won't have a noticeable effect, or at least the effect is sort of hidden by enough other factors going on that we're not really going to see.
Unless we sort of see a big return to manufacturing and other high CapEx sort of style businesses.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Another effect is this poor returns on acquisition. So basically large companies tend to have quite poor returns on acquisitions over time. So mm-hmm. so companies that do big acquisitions generally lose money
yep.
On the deal.
But gain market share.
But gain market share and higher management salaries and yep. all this other stuff. So the argument there is that if companies are actually paying out lots of dividends, then when that comes time to get an acquisition, they don't have the cash sort of sitting ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
They've actually got to go out to the market and raise the money. And so they've got to justify, they've actually got to go out, well, I want to buy this thing. It's going to cost me, you know, an extra few billion dollars. I don't have it lying around because I've been paying out all my dividends as fast as I can.
Yep.
I've now got to go and justify why I need to raise that money. That's harder and gives an extra hurdle. And so the argument is you get better acquisitions because they have to go through that
yeah.
process.
Okay, fascinating.
Which is quite possible. And so, you know, I'd expect that to be a factor of Australian dividends.
Yep, sure.
And the final thing is the effect on the corporate debt market. I'm pretty sure that the Australian corporate debt market is very stunted.
Mm.
So relative to, like most Australian corporates will, if they're raising money on the debt markets, they'll tend to do it offshore.
Mm-hmm.
And the local market's quite small. There's quite a reasonable argument that a lot of the reason why the market's quite small is because people love franking credits so much is that they don't bother going out to find these higher yield debt securities.
Yep.
Because, well, I can get the same from buying a dividend on 4.5% and yep. I get my franking credits back and now I'm at 6.5%.
And upside.
And these things are only yielding 6.5 or 7 anyway, so why bother?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And so, so quite possibly it's at the margin these changes will be positive for the Australian corporate debt market. And you might mm-hmm. see a little bit more of a lift of... more people interested if you're not getting a 6% return on your shares now, but you're mm-hmm. only getting a 4% return.
Yep.
Maybe then you go out and look at some corporate debt, which might give you those types of returns.
So you think we might find, pension mode investors now looking to climb up the capital ladder essentially and start chasing these corporate debt. Yeah, interesting. Mm. All right, that's great. Okay, very good. So look, we'll jump across now into the investment outlook. And you've entitled this one, Beware the Vested Interest. So I think we've covered off on a few today, but anyway,
yeah. Keep going. I guess the biggest thing I wanted to highlight, and we're not immune to this as well, is that whoever you're listening to on this probably has a vested interest in it.
Mm.
And so there's a bunch of people who are going to lose out from this. So people, Australian-only fund managers, so they're going to have less flows in there. So you will yep. see people like your Jeff Wilsons and people like that leading the charge in terms of trying to get this thing overturned. Because it does make a big difference to their business model.
Yep.
You've
also got there's a number of funds out there that just farm franking credits as well through high dividend yielding stocks, and they just horse trade them
yep.
with, you know, generally big tax liability potential. But if you're, you know, if you've got owned in a pension fund, you don't have to worry about that tax. So
yes,
yeah, I've seen those. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sure.
And so so that makes it less useful. So those people are going to be out. And where I'm coming to from this is, if everyone's got a vested interest, you need to, as they're giving you their arguments as to whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, you need to weigh up and say, well, I know you're losing out from this. So the fact you're telling me this is terrible, it's the worst thing in the world and the sky's going to fall, I need to take that with a bit of a grain of salt. And on the flip side, there's some winners who you need to say, well, the fact you're telling me this is going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread also needs to be taken into account that, you know, it might not be...
Might be pushing your wagon as well.
Yeah, that's right. So those the self-managed super fund providers are obviously really going to get hit because it just makes self-managed super that little bit less attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Accountants over the long term, for those reasons I was talking about before, that over the long term, it's much nicer to play the hero every year and say, here's all your franking credits back, Tim, and you won't even notice my fee because I've netted out.
Absolutely.
Yep. Whereas in the short term, though, it's probably a good thing that, you know, they'll be changing people's structures to move around and so those Aussie stockbrokers, retirees, poor people, or certainly with a low taxable income.
I put that in brackets there. Yeah, so yeah, not necessarily poor. Yeah, that's right.
And so and part of that is really it's the intersection that's the real problem for those, is saying, well, if it's something that affecting rich retirees that weren't going to pay any tax, then that's a positive from a tax fairness.
Mm-hmm.
But from a marginal taking out those people who are just outside the pension, and we're managing to you know, you don't want to have them end up on the back of it. So it would be good to see a few sort of tapering or some changes, and quite possibly that, you know, that might end up coming through.
And keeping in mind always that, you know, just because you've got a couple of hundred grand worth of stocks in your own name, and you're in a, you know, a low taxable income or whatever it is, and, you know, these are going to affect you, it doesn't mean that you have to be in stocks, those stocks forever. Like, it's, you know, look, there's work involved, obviously, in reviewing and trying to find something new, but the status quo is never going to remain the status quo forever as well. So,
yep.
Absolutely. Okay. And it's just a couple of winners there.
Winners, yeah. Tax quality, industry super funds.
Is that another term for us? Is that or the general Australian population through increased receipts?
I think it's maybe the younger.
Okay.
The younger part of the population.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, it's a relatively recent, 10 something years that we've given all these tax free pensions.
Mm.
So, it's pretty much unfundable.
Mm.
You can't have everyone getting tax-free pensions forever, and
yep.
You know, so it will change at some point. So the sooner it changes, the better for younger people, because otherwise, it's basically you've got a whole cohort of people who go through their retirement not paying any tax, and then
keeping in mind that a lot of people are retired for almost as long as they've worked these days as well.
And then as the younger generation are just hitting that level, they're saying, "Well, we had free education and all this other stuff, but it's no longer affordable." And now they're saying, "Well, we had tax-free pensions, but that's no longer affordable either." And,
it could be something. Yeah.
So, industry super funds is the other one that's worth noting. They're one of the big winners you'd expect, in that, just given their pooled nature and people moving back from self-managed super funds back to industry funds. Mm. And so, you know, I guess there are people who would draw a line between the Labor government, Labor Party, and industry super funds, and conclude that's sort of why it's a positive, and
why
it's on the table. Yep. there's probably some truth to that argument. The other thing, property trusts, utilities.
Yeah, so tell us a bit more about that. How are they winners?
They're paying unfranked dividends at the moment, so in a relative sense, those dividends become more attractive.
Yep, okay, yep, fair enough.
And the last one, that residential investment property. You know, residential investment property is obviously a bit on the nose at the moment, and we're not a huge fan, but it's a tried and true favourite for avoiding tax.
Yep.
And so, you know, at the margin, you'd think if accountants could no longer can tell people buy this and avoid use that to avoid tax, then you'd think they'd be using residential investment property
to validate the fee.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough. Okay, sure thing. All right, and we'll wrap it up now with the final investment outlook. So final notes, Damien.
So, you know, you spoke through a few things about the investment structure, well worth considering. Yeah, if you're thinking about getting a SMSF, or you do have an SMSF, you need to just reconsider some of the maths. Won't be as attractive as what it was before. You can look at putting an extra member into it, and noting that it doesn't need to be particularly large salaries to help offset that. And some of that will be, we still don't know about the rules about how it's going to be allocated.
Mm.
You might find that means you can keep some of these franking credit benefits, but you might also find that actually just means that your franking credit benefits go to helping the other members of your super fund.
Yeah.
So generally, I'm assuming they're people you like, and you don't, you know, given it's not your money.
Well, I guess, given the option of either helping your own family out or helping out a larger pool of unknown, Master Trust super members.
Exactly.
You've probably got something
there. Your own family. For most people, they choose their own family, but it is worth, you know, for future structuring, it's possibly a way of, you know, passing on money
that's right. I mean, family wealth,
the next generation.
That's right. You can take it out of their Christmas bonus or their Christmas present at the end of the year, your franking credit.
That's right.
International stocks,
your Christmas present adjusted for franking credits. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so that's the investment structure. I think at the margin, international stocks are going to be more attractive, especially if pensions in pension mode. Having said that, we think you probably shouldn't care too much about the tax anyway.
Yep.
We don't think there's going to be heaps of changes for capital allocation of companies. We still think that the changes are minor enough that you'll see the same. And there'll probably be a few minor benefits in terms of the in terms of the debt markets, and possibly helping to expand that a little bit.
So increase liquidity in the corporate debt market.
Corporate debt market.
Yep. Okay, sure. And looking at home, looking at our portfolios?
We look a little bit at the structure of our income portfolios. So there'll certainly be, you know, a little bit of a consideration. Mm-hmm. One of the considerations is that, you know, people in pension mode in income funds do get the benefit of those franking credits.
Yep.
And so it's not a huge one, but it is certainly, you know, play a difference. At the margin, we'll be less likely to if we're weighing up two stocks of equal standing,
yep,
and one of them's paying franked dividends and the other one isn't, we're less likely to be, you know, whereas before we'd go, okay, equal standing, let's go with the one with franking credits.
Yep.
Now we'll be saying, well, we don't really care. Let's try and find some other way to
try and find the best use of the money without the tax incentive.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure thing. And broadly, I guess, because we're across our portfolios, we do have a general underweighting to Aussie stocks. So does that then once again sort of negate, I guess, some of the effects of these franking credit changes in our portfolios?
Yeah. Well, as I said before, I'd expect that this will make a little bit of a difference to the Aussie price in a relative sense. Mm-hmm. A couple of percent, you'd knock off what people would pay for an Australian stock.
Yep.
When I say a couple, you know, 1-2%. So it's not massive amounts. It's
still
not
like something getting close to daily movements again.
Exactly. It's not something you'd actually actively trade. And who knows when that happens? You know, that will be put in over a period of time as to when people think, you know, there's probably 0.5% of that priced in already, where people are like, well, the land is going to win. And then the closer it gets and more certain, you get a little bit more of it. So so it's not something you'd trade directly, but it is something worth sort of keeping in mind.
Yep. Okay. Fantastic. All right. Very good. Well, look, thanks for that. That was a great wrap-up of franking credits and you, and I hope you enjoyed that. Coming up next week, we do have a special guest, Phil Soos, on again. So he joined us late last year, and we thought we'd get him in again to give us his thoughts on the findings of the Royal Commission, the report that came out a couple of weeks ago. Really looking forward to that as a banking, what would you call it, banking larceny tragic, for want of a better word.
And he's also... Phil's an expert in the Aussie market, the Aussie housing market over the long term, and so writes a lot of good stuff on that. So it'd be very good to get his views on the latest in the Australian housing market as well, and the effects.
100%. Yeah, look, I'm really looking forward to that. So that's Thursday, the 7th of March. As always, same bad time, same bad channel, 12:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. And for that, of course, you can head over to the Nucleus World live webinar page, and we can view it there at that time. So going forth from there. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.